Hi, everyone. I'm attorney Donna DiMaggio-Berger, and this is Take It to the Board, where we speak condo and HOA.
If you live in a multifamily building, an elevator is usually a necessary part of your life. Some people love them, some hate them, and some actually fear them. In fact, there's a term for that, elevatophobia. One thing is certain, elevators require consistent updates and maintenance to remain safe and aesthetically pleasing. Our guest today, Todd Schwartz, has worked for Otis, ThyssenKrupp, and Ace Elevator Companies before founding his current company, Connections Elevator, in 2011. Todd and I will also be discussing his new venture with electric vehicle charging stations. Todd is a native Floridian. He is a graduate of the University of Florida, as well as a graduate of the University of Miami Business School. Todd, welcome to Take It to the Board.
Thank you so much for having me, Donna.
So what got you interested in working with elevators? Did they fascinate you as a kid or something?
No, not at all. I actually graduated, and my first job out of school was working in association property management in the mid-90s. You know, it was a very demanding job. I was a portfolio manager, so that meant I had multiple properties that I had to be at many places at the same time, dealing with many type of issues. And I said, man, there's got to be an easier way to have a work life than have to multitask so many problems all at the same time with multiple evening meetings, et cetera, et cetera. So I actually befriended a sales rep who worked for Otis Elevator at one of the properties that I worked with. And he had told me that he was leaving to go work at another company. And I said, hey, can you put my name in the hat? And that's how I kind of got into elevators.
So, you know, for somebody who works in an industry for a long time, like you with elevators or me as an association attorney, often we think like there's nothing new under the sun, right? But you constantly see new things in your industry.
Yeah, I mean, elevators, when we first started, you know, they kind of told us that if an elevator is properly maintained, it'll last the life of the building. And obviously, we've seen with, you know, technology and technological obsolescence, the sayings and the business philosophy just, you know, 20 years ago has obviously greatly changed.
So what other innovations are out there?
We're finding, you know, that all of a sudden in the last couple of years, there's a lot of new technological enhancements to our industry. Everything from destination dispatch, where the traditional way of going to the first floor and pressing an up or down button. Now you touch a screen and you say what floor you're going to, and then it'll tell you which elevator to go to, as opposed to the more traditional way. We're now seeing a lot of demand because a lot of the newer buildings now have touch screen, like an iPad inside the elevator. We call those basically touchscreen car operating panels. So a lot of the modernization projects, we're seeing that type of technology. And then we're also seeing the video screens, very similar to a lot of in the hotels that you would see in other travels where you might see the weather or the stock market information. But associations are actually asking not as much for live information screens, but a lot of the managers will get it and appreciate it so that they no longer, instead of having to post, you know, a notice that they have to put, you know, the building and shut down a water line and have the maintenance staff go to every single floor and knock on every door and do stuff like that, these screens inside the elevators will allow to put information in a much quicker, much more time efficient way.
And much more aesthetically pleasing way to have it on a screen as opposed to a piece of paper tacked on the wall.
With digital graphics and, you know, all that kind of cool stuff. So, you know, we can put the logo in the background. We can, you know, do all kinds of real cool things and have rotating pictures of, you know, some of the upgrades that the building's done. So for sure, it's definitely a lot more aesthetically pleasant and more modern.
What constitutes, Todd, a typical elevator modernization project? So we hear that a lot, and I know it's different from a repair project. So what is a modernization project? What does that entail?
You know, the best way I can explain it is kind of using analogies to the human body. In an elevator modernization, there are four major components that get replaced. The first being the controller, which I like to compare to the brain. The second being the fixtures, which are the buttons inside and outside of the elevator. Then there's the door operator, which is kind of like the arms of the body. And then lastly is the heart, which is in a hydraulic elevator system, which is an oil system. That's the pumping unit. Or for a traction elevator, that would be the hoist machine, which again, the analogy is kind of like the heart. Those four major components are the major things that get changed in an elevator modernization and become most relatable to a board or a property manager, because often they have never stepped foot in an elevator machine room or don't plan on stepping foot in the elevator machine room. So it kind of really helps explain to both them and their residents, you know, what they're really getting for this big dollar ticket item.
But do you have to replace all four components for it to constitute a modernization?
No. So great question. Often a modernization will happen for a variety of reasons. It could be because the current provider or the manufacturer says that a component is now obsolete and now must be replaced, and just that component must be done. It could be as part of the 40-year certification process. But that being said, when you change the brains, the controller, everything at that point must come up to current code. You don't have to do all four. But if you change the controller, most, if not all, of those four major components can be changed. In some cases, for value engineering purposes, the one item that can kind of be a la carted out is the heart, either the pumping unit or the hoist machine. But that really just depends on the unique, specific circumstances. Often, also in an elevator modernization, it's probably done every 20 to 30 years. So in some of the buildings that we're working with, the buildings were built in the 60s or 70s. And now in the year 2022, they're on their third time around of modernizing their elevators, where some of the components might not have been replaced the second time they modernized, but on the third time they need to.
So what's the typical downtime, Todd, if you're modern? Let's take one elevator. What would be the downtime where that elevator would be out of service while you're undertaking this project?
You know, there's a general rule of thumb in the elevator industry that it's roughly 1 week per floor it takes to do an elevator modernization. But to be very clear and to really get a very important message across, that's only for the downtime of the actual performance of the work. So on a six-story building, using that rule of thumb of 1 week per floor, it's 6 weeks of inconvenience to residents. We've, modernized successfully many over 55 communities where they only have one elevator. And we obviously understand the urgency to get that elevator running as quickly as possible. But what we found, or I found over the last 20 plus years of doing this, is the real downtime and the real thing that the associations really need to be taking into consideration is the lead time for the manufacturing of the equipment. Because if a service provider or a manufacturer says that, the elevator can no longer work because one of these components has failed and there is no life use left, it's not just the 6 weeks of downtime to do the installation of the work, but this equipment must be custom made for each property. Not too long ago, the lead times for some equipment on a hydraulic elevator could be 4 to 6 weeks, and on traction equipment could be 2 to 3 months. But as we obviously know, what's been going on in the economy and with logistics and all of this stuff, they've been doubled. So on that scenario of a six-story elevator, if they don't proactively prepare the financing, the bidding process, the manufacturing project, that one elevator isn't down just for 6 weeks of installation time. It could be down for six months, 9 months to get the lead times of all the equipment, which would be really a detrimental problem for a single elevator building in particular.
Well, I was going to ask you about buildings with just one elevator. So what are those residents expected to do if it's six stories and you have elderly, perhaps disabled people living on the upper floors? Are they just expected to walk down to leave the building? Are there any other options? I don't know that you're going to have lifts, or is there a temporary elevator you can put in, or no?
No, it's all about communication. The more that you can proactively handle it, and as I said earlier, we've successfully done elevator modernization projects on many over 55 communities or properties with one elevator. And it's all about just properly communicating to the residents. That six-story elevator is not the common of an over 55 community. Maybe it's four stories and it's 4 weeks and accelerated schedule and working some overtime. If it's not cost prohibitive, is an option. But regardless, 24 hours or 48 hours of not having an elevator is a major issue in these communities. So again, we found successfully that over communicating to the residents, giving them enough advance notice, letting them know to go visit family members, to come up with alternative housing solutions. When boards and management companies do that, these projects go off a lot better, and only elevators so urgent for the residents.
Well, preparation is key, and I wanted to ask you about so-called elevator consultants. When people mention an elevator consultant, is that really just another name for somebody like you going out talking about your own company? Or is that an independent consultant that would come out and talk to a board or a manager about, the different options, the different companies out there?
So elevator consultants should be independent contractors who basically should be educating their clients on the right customer-centric solutions moving forward. Obviously, when a developer builds a building, the residents and the board really have no say in what's going into their property. So things like the conversation of proprietary versus non-proprietary equipment, the conversations of union versus non-union labor workforce, privately held companies versus publicly traded companies, and the prices associated with those type of situations. The consultant who would get hired by the board of directors should be educating them on all those scenarios, because in most cases, otherwise, the current elevator service provider will give a proposal. The management company will hope to get two or three other, hopefully, apples to apples bids. But often in our case, it's found that they're not apples to apples, not because the board or the elevator company doesn't want it to do so, but just nobody really knows how to really true up and look at all three bids and make sure that all the components are quoted the same, that a global manufacturer controller is any better or not better, or what is the long-term best case scenario compared to these non-proprietary manufacturers that have been around for 20 or 30 or longer years. The union versus non-union pros and cons of both installation schedule, cost structure. So again, that's really where the value of a consultant comes in, to really have the lens of customer-centric, what's in the best interest of the client, and not just, you know, the contractor selling what's best for them to sell.
Right, his own services. Yeah, it's very similar, Todd, to what our clients use when they're looking to negotiate a bulk cable contract or internet. You know, there are telecom consultants that they will bring in independent. They are not selling the service, but what they're selling is their expertise in kind of sitting with the board and helping them look through all the different options, the different rates, and the different tech out there. So one of the biggest complaints I get, though, from so many of my clients is that there's not a lot of choices in Florida, and this may be true nationwide, when it comes to elevator companies. Do you know how many elevator companies actually operate in Florida?
I don't have the specific number. That's something that's set up through the State of Florida Elevator Division. But for the argument of this conversation, we'll say it's a couple hundred. They're all registered elevator companies through the state of Florida. You've got the four largest global manufacturers, and you've got plenty of independent contractors, both, again, union workforce, non-union workforce, privately held family-owned companies like my own, or companies that are publicly traded, or, you know, there's been a lot of new entrants to our market of private equity-based, but there is definitely a lot more options than most people think. It's almost very similar to the analogy I use of an individual and who can service their car. There's this perception that, you know, if you have a Honda, the Honda dealership is the only company that can service your elevator. And for a variety of reasons, maybe that's the case. But especially after the manufacturer's warranty period expires, you know, there's, you know, successfully many independent car dealership or car repair shops or car service shops who are successfully able, for a variety of reasons, to be in business. And I like to compare that very similar to elevators and elevator maintenance and repair companies compared to the analogy of thinking and again, for the role of either consultants or management companies and having preferred vendors or qualified vendors. But for sure, there are definitely a lot more options than most people think. It's just an awareness issue.
Absolutely. And I'm so glad you mentioned that because, you know, listen, in the intro, I named the various very large companies, elevator companies that you worked for. I see the same elevator company names over and over and over again when my clients are considering either a modernization project or just a service contract. Speaking of contracts, I think the reason that, you know, we keep seeing the same names over and over again is because a lot of these companies really do lock in associations for decades with a particular company. I don't know if you're aware of the litigation years, it was decades ago, but it was somebody complaining about a particular lease and that it just had that automatic renewal that kept rolling over. And if you missed a very narrow window of opportunity to cancel, you rolled over for another decade or even 20 years. And I think a lot of times that's why Associations don't think they have a choice, Todd, because they've been locked into these very long-term contracts. So I'm going to put you a little bit on the spot here, Todd. How much flexibility do you offer with your agreement? Because listen, as an association attorney, I will tell you, whatever you present to me, I'm not going to love, and I'm going to want to make certain changes for my association client.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect it any different, Donna. I mean, you brought up some examples earlier about the cable contracts, right? The cable contracts are known very long-term. The washing machine contracts, also historically known as very long-term contracts. The elevator industry, by nature, is typically a five-year agreement. And why is it 5 years? I can't tell you, other than that's the way it's always been. But just because that's the way it's always been does not mean that's the way it needs to be moving forward. From my viewpoint, contracts are supposed to be win-win scenarios. Sometimes, you know, we'll get addendums from association attorneys and it's so one-sided that we have issues. But I've found that when two parties want to do business, you find scenarios to create win-win scenarios. So particular for my organization, we look to those type of scenarios. We are open-minded to any and all talking points to discuss, as long as it's under the premise of win-win scenarios. And absolutely, our industry needs to have some shaking up because there are some bad feelings or bad experiences by clients and association attorneys with some of these contracts that roll over again and again. So absolutely, our industry needs to change and hopefully is evolving in that regard.
You know, I say that to vendors, Todd, because the reality is there's a lot of inertia with associations. And the bottom line is they're not looking to swap out vendors every other year. If you're doing a good job, they're going to stick with you. So I agree. It's just good business to give that flexibility. And just as long as you're providing a good service, the board's likely to stick with you.
The only disclaimer I would put in there, Donna, is unlike certain services where there real is no expensive replacement cost of material, with all due respect to a pool service contract or a grass cutting contract, there just needs to be some understanding when it pertains to elevators, you know, because one component or board can cost a couple thousand dollars. So again, language, mutually beneficial performance clauses, all of those type of provisions should be in there to protect the association. So it's just not a, whatever the term contract, the association stuck and there are no deliverables that the service provider has to deliver to.
So before we jump off modernization and switch to regular maintenance, I want to ask you, when you modernize an elevator, it's reasonable to expect that it's going to be faster, right? I mean, I laugh, but I mentioned to you earlier, I'm from Chicago. It was the Sears Tower when I grew up there, and now it's called the Willis Tower. But I feel like I could get to the top, you know, to the 103rd floor sky deck quicker than I can get to the fifth floor in some of the buildings I visit. Does a modernization project always result in a faster elevator?
For the average person, the answer would be no. You know, the changing of the heart on a traction elevator from a geared, originally designed to a gearless could make it faster, but there are a lot more variables that have to go into play. And without getting too technical, there's space requirements for some of the stuff. So the ride quality is actually where residents would actually see the difference in a modernization. You know, for example, if the hoist machine gets replaced from a geared to a gearless. But, you know, the better question that I'm often asked by people is, you know, we're in a six-story condominium, and the condominium where I live, the elevator is much slower than the six-story office building that I'm in. And how can that be? It seems to be so much faster at work. Well, the first question that I ask people, because there's this assumption that a six-story elevator is a six-story elevator.
Right. It's going up the same six stories, right?
Right. But, you know, if it's a Class A office building, it's very well possible that that might be a gearless traction elevator that is designed to go at 300 feet per minute, where the elevator at the association might be a hydraulic elevator, which, you know, on average is designed to go at 150 feet per minute. So, you know, again, there's just this assumption that, you know, six-story is six-story, and it's not often the case. It's really more what the actual equipment is, a hydraulic or traction, and what was the end result that the client was looking for. And obviously, from a price point and moving of traffic of the bodies in a, you know, Class A office building versus in a residential, you know, maybe only elevator building, maybe it's not as relevant. Or, you know, how many elevators?
Is one more problem-free than the other, hydraulic versus gearless?
So,
or safer even?
No, I mean, listen, they're all equally safe. They all have this different code requirements and safety tests. The hydraulic system is more a closed loop oil system, very similar to, again, going back to car dealerships and the car lifts that the mechanic would put a car on. That was kind of like the original concept of where the hydraulic elevator concept came from. The traction elevators started back in, you know, with Elijah Otis back in the World Trade Fair and have evolved to a different mechanism, but gearless traction, it's basically a pulley system like a seesaw, and they've been around a long time. They're very safe components. It has more to do with, again, the speed, the cost. Those are really the drivers, and again, why it's so important to have consultants or service providers that are really looking, especially in a modernization, you know, what's the right product for the customer and what they're trying to achieve.
I'm going to nerd out on you a little bit here because this is really interesting to me. I've never thought about elevators so much as I was when prepping for today's episode. If you had an association that had a hydraulic elevator system, could they switch during the modernization project to a gearless system? Is that even feasible?
If there's enough room in the elevator hoistway, they would need to have enough room to where you're going to put the equipment. So we've seen conversions from... It's actually the opposite. I once worked many years ago with a client in St. Petersburg, Florida, where, remember, traction elevators have been around much longer than hydraulic elevators. So this one particular project in St. Petersburg, they had a much older traction elevator that they wanted to modernize. And because it was so much more costly to modernize a traction elevator, we were able to actually give them a new elevator, but a hydraulic elevator. You could go the other way and as well change a hydraulic to a traction, but there would be a lot of boxes that would need to be checked to comply with code and other type of things. But anything is possible depending on one's budget and if there's not limitations in space.
Right. So let's talk about maintenance. How often does an elevator need to be maintained and what's involved with that maintenance?
Our industry has historically defined that in the service contracts. I'm sure you love when you see it as regularly and systematically.
Right. What does that mean?
Yeah, that means to be held as little as accountable as possible. But, you know, to answer the specific question, the reality is it depends on the type of elevator. Is it a hydraulic elevator? Is it a traction elevator? How many stories is it? How many stories does the elevator open in the front or does it open in the front and rear? You know, a lot of the newer higher end buildings today. Now, you know, back in the day, the elevators would open to a common hallway. Some they open to a unit, but it's only for one unit and it opens in the front and rear. All of those different variables all impact how frequently, what the cost should be. On top of there are code requirements. So to answer as simplistically as possible, I would say that obviously regularly and systematically is not good language for a client to have. But in the same breath, each elevator service company, depending uniquely on what they particularly have and the number of elevators, it should not be an issue to come up with some type of performance criteria of how often in hours per month per elevator, depending on the unique situation, so that there's some understanding. And I often like to use the analogy of grass cutting or pool service to get away from a per month fee into a per cut or per service understanding so that in pools, right? If it rains for an entire month, you know, do you still pay the contractor even though no one came for the month? Mm-hmm. So in the same breath, like an elevator service company shouldn't get paid for 3 months if they didn't go for 3 months. So there needs to be some check and balance. And so, you know, we'll often put in contracts those type of criteria, the minimum preventative maintenance hours per month, to tie into some price so that there's some protection for the association to get away from, again, that trap of many years and not getting the level of service that they've been paying for.
No, that makes sense. Todd, there's always regular updates to the building code, and those updates often pertain to elevators. I know a few years ago, elevators had to be retrofitted with uniform keys. And right now, there's a pending December 31st, 23 deadline to install safety doors in all Florida elevators. How is this communicated? How are these deadlines, other than people like me and association attorneys, so, you know, we will tell our clients and management companies will, but how is that information disseminated? Typically.
Yeah. So the state basically adopts the National Elevator Code. So in this particular case, there was a change that had to do with the door lock monitoring. And so in most cases, the associations are not going to find out about this need for compliance until an annual inspection is done by a third-party elevator inspector, who will then write up a violation to the association for not being in compliance.
Is there a fine associated at that point?
No. They have 90 days to correct. Okay. But it's going to be a costly repair, and there might be a backlog if a large portion of elevators in the state of Florida need to do this, those who are more proactive will obviously be ahead of it. So it's not pending. It's by December 2023, elevators that currently do not have door lock monitoring are going to need to have it to be in compliance. So there is also a lot of confusion, and we've seen some aggressive sales tactics by some companies on which elevators will need to be in compliance, which ones won't. The most two simplistic ways to help associations get the answer that they need is two things. One, if the original manufacturer, i.e. the controller manufacturer, is still in business, ask them for a letter in writing to state that their particular elevator has that feature. Now, in some cases, we've seen some clients ask us because for whatever reason, those manufacturers are being very slow in responding. But that is obviously one way to do it. But in some cases, we've actually had clients, because they've been frustrated with companies not giving them the answers that they need, then they've asked us to test it for them. And there's an actual test that you can do, just like the inspectors want to do, to confirm that the feature is actually operational or not.
Just explain I know it's a safety door, but can you explain how it operates?
Well, basically the door lock monitoring is to prevent circuitry from being jumped for other reasons. The most simplistic way of saying it is it's basically done to prevent elevator mechanics from doing certain things that would prevent the functionality of operating correctly. And there's obviously a reason why this has gone into effect, because certain things happen to individuals that we never want to have happen again.
That's actually a perfect segue into what I said at the outset in the introduction, that some people actually have phobias about using elevators. I know a few people who will not use elevators. They will only use the stairs. And, you know, thankfully, we don't hear often about fatalities associated with the use of elevators, but it happens. Have you personally seen, I think you were just alluding to that a minute ago, have you seen fatalities, unfortunately, over the course of your career?
I mean, I personally haven't seen them. They have happened here. They have happened in other markets. It's a terrible thing. You know, the elevator industry in that regard is very much a tight community, that when accidents, let alone fatalities, occur, I mean, nobody wants to see that. So, you know, during the day, we're all in the field. We're all competing against each other, trying to take business from one another. But when there's an accident, or, you know, God forsake a fatality, I mean, it's devastating, obviously, to the entire industry. And we all don't want to see that happen. So it is all about education, safety, and making sure that certain codes are passed to try to prevent from ever happening again.
What I've only seen is people stuck in elevators. You're stuck in an elevator. I assume pushing every button is not the answer. What's the first thing you do if you're stuck in an elevator?
Take a big deep breath.
I like that advice. Okay. And after you take a big deep breath, what you push all the buttons.
You press the one that has got the picture next to it with the elevator phone, and hopefully somebody responds. If somebody doesn't respond, you then take out your cell phone and you call whoever you need to call, or you hit the alarm button. But the reality is someone is going to respond and someone is going to safely get you out. But the best people and the most trained people to get you safely out of the elevator is going to be 911. Back in the day, every building used to have one of those door retrieval keys that was able to get someone out of the elevator. But I have seen myself personally, where I've been involved with, you know, helping explain how certain things occur that can be avoided. And those keys that the people used to have shouldn't be in anyone's possession. So when someone gets stuck, if you're inside the elevator, big deep breath, call, hit the alarm. Someone is going to notify, you know, the fire department or 911 to get the appropriate personnel properly trained to safely get you out. But you're going to be safe in the elevator. You just got to relax and wait for the proper person to retrieve you. And if you're on the other side of the elevator, and if you're not properly trained and you're not the fire department, you need to call 911. And again, help and communicate with the person inside the elevator so that if someone does have anxiety issues or whatever it is, be there with them, communicate with them, keep them calm until the appropriate parties get there. But the appropriate trained personnel needs to be the only personnel to get those people out.
You heard it here first, folks. Let's lay a myth to rest. They are not going to run out of air in the elevator cab. There is airflow, correct?
Absolutely. There's both an exhaust fan and there's grills that allow the flow of air.
So even if you're stuck in there for much longer than you anticipated, you're not going to run out of oxygen.
Nope. There might not be the right music. There might not be any music. You might not get cell phone service and you might not be able to, you know, watch something on your cell phone to keep you company.
And you might not like who you're stuck with in the elevator, but you're not going to suffocate. There will be air.
And you will be safe.
Todd, I know the standard protocol, because we do this even drills in our building, is never use an elevator in the event of an emergency, such as a fire. But are there any exceptions to that rule where an elevator will get you out of a building quicker?
You walk and you take the stairs. That's why they have the code signs at every floor and engraved all over the place. In case of fire, take the stairs. Because the second that a smoke sensor goes off or otherwise, those elevators are going to be triggered. And they are going to recall to the first floor or the appropriate landing that it needs to get to. And it will not be able to go back into operation until the properly trained personnel, in most cases the fire department, inserts, as you mentioned earlier, those universal fire service keys. And then they will take control of the elevator in phase one, either in the lobby or in phase two inside the elevator. But yes, take the stairs.
Got it. You mentioned earlier about consistent upgrades. There's a group called the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, or ASME. Is that the entity that makes these suggestions?
They're actually the body that created the original elevator code, and they make the adoptions of upgraded code requirements. Then it is the state's responsibility to adopt or accept them. And in some markets, like New York or Chicago, local municipalities might have above and beyond different or greater adoptions that they might accept. But yes, that organization is basically the governing body that comes up with the code changes that they then present for adoption at the different jurisdictions.
How do you get on that board?
That's a great question and way outside my technical pay grade.
Is it people selling elevator parts who are on that board?
No, absolutely not.
Some of my communities, Todd, they require the use of a Shabbos or Sabbath elevator. And for our listeners who've never heard that term before, can you explain how those elevators work? And I should say, in my communities that use them, it's normally one elevator out of many that they, you know, install this component in.
Yeah, so the Sabbath operation has to do with buildings where they have observant Jewish population, and it goes into the concept of where a person or individual who wants to use the elevator isn't supposed to be touching anything of power or electricity. So the Sabbath operation feature would allow the elevator to kind of operate on its own. In the older systems to accomplish that, we've seen all kinds of MacGyvering or jerry-rigging of systems where, you know, they would take a sprinkler clock with a manual flip of a switch to get it going. And then when the Sabbath was over, they'd turn the switch off and it would stop functioning. On the newer systems, obviously, they're very much more software-driven. So they can be programmed with date and time so people don't have to run to the machine room to get it going and not get it going. But basically, in concept, the feature is someone would be able to enter from the first floor or the lobby, and the elevator will stop floor by floor by floor all the way up and floor by floor all the way on the way down, so that the person at the lobby does not need to press the hall button. The person then would not have to go inside the elevator and press their particular floor. It eventually will get to their floor. And conversely, a person who was in their unit who needed to get down or move inside the building would equally be able to enter, not at their floor, would not have to hit the button, get inside the elevator, would not have to hit a button. Now, the reason why often it only happens on one elevator in a building is because it now greatly slows down the traffic flow. Right. For the rest of the building.
Because it's going to every floor continually for what, 8 hours? Just stopping on every floor?
Oh, well, it's from basically sundown to sundown. So it's 12 hours.
Just right. Yeah, you better not have one elevator, or, I mean, unless you're in a very tiny building, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, it's It's a feature that is required in some buildings, and what we've described is kind of a standard feature. We've very rarely, but run in some clients who've come from the Northeast who have a different interpretation or want a more extreme interpretation of how it functions. And on the newer systems, they can be custom programmed, obviously for an additional feature and cost. But for the most part, that's kind of how it works, in concept that the passenger doesn't need to press any buttons and the elevator will operate. And you really don't want it going longer than 12 hours because you think about the additional wear and tear it puts on the elevator working in that type of functionality for 12 hours straight.
Well, you mentioned technology, and I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, listen, we're kind of got the pandemic in our rearview mirror. I remember back in early 2020, our phones were ringing off the hook with boards, you know, trying to figure out which amenities they needed to shut down. And, you know, this was pre-vaccine. And of course, those communities that had elevators, this was a huge, huge issue because a lot of times you're talking about a very tiny space and we wanted people wearing masks. Some people were even wearing gloves. Back then, remember, we were wiping down groceries. Nobody knew exactly whether or not it was transmissible, you know, on surfaces. So what kind of technology is kind of on the horizon? Or I should start by saying, what kind of technology came out of the pandemic? I would imagine touchless, right?
That came a little late. There were some companies that did everything from foot pedals in lieu of having to touch the buttons. You know, we saw people who were buying on Amazon these little keys, these metal keys, so they didn't have to touch the button, but it was creating other issues because they were cracking the plastic buttons.
I have one, Todd. Don't mock me.
So
it was given to me. I didn't buy it. It was given to me.
Yeah. So, you know, we saw that kind of stuff. The most common thing that most people, other than obviously the basics and wearing gloves, and I myself at one point was wearing gloves to touch the buttons, was basically to do with the air quality. So a lot of companies came out with different types of air purification systems that tied into the fans inside the elevator and all that stuff. But to be honest, it's been many months, if not over a year, where really that curiosity of what's out there and what we're going to do, it's really kind of teetered down.
I'm wondering if we're ever going to have like an Alexa type situation in elevators where you can just say, take me to a floor and have it voice activated.
Yeah, early on, we were asked by a client to do some research on that, and we did. And there was a particular company in Europe that had such a product. And upon doing my due diligence and asking if they had any United States installations, the answer, unfortunately, was no. But, you know, we started to pop some holes in some of the technology with a non-global production company like an Amazon. So Amazon, if you're listening, maybe there is something for you. But for this particular company who is using their product, if you think about it, there are so many dialects, so many accents just here in South Florida alone that, you know, I have a hard time sometimes just voice texting and the phone understanding who I am, that I think it's going to take some major dollars and or if ever possible to really get, you know, what makes, you know, South Florida so unique with all the different accents and languages to get the uniform language to get that to kind of work.
Let's talk about electric vehicle charging stations. If I understand this correctly, you've recently gotten into this space. What are you doing with them?
A lot of our clients basically started asking me, you know, hey, this is kind of similar to elevators or, you know, what do you know about it? So by the third or fourth time, I kind of said, you know what, I got to do a little more due diligence here. So I put a team together and we're basically working with a separate entity, Connections Charging. And basically we are helping associations more in an owner's rep capacity, kind of like an elevator consultant, to make sure that they're understanding the long-term needs of their residents, both from a hardware perspective, what's required on the electrical upgrading side, because there's a lot of moving components that with associations with limited funds, we want to make sure that they're doing this properly. It's almost, again, like the analogy of what happened originally when buildings started to go with hurricane shutters. And, you know, at one point, every unit owner just went at it and they did their own thing. And then there was uniformity issues amongst other issues. So I'm trying to take you know, my 20 plus years of dealing with associations and with elevators from property management, and try to proactively help these clients in trying to avoid some of the landmines from other industries, because there's no doubt, and I've not found one person who's going to tell me that this is not the future, right? Electric cars is the future. It's already here. And where a couple of years ago, I had been asked about it and kind of thought about it, there's no doubt. I mean, it is the most common topic of conversation at any and every building that I'm at these days.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the law changed a few years ago, Todd, where now an association cannot prohibit someone in Florida from installing their own electrical vehicle charging station in their assigned parking space or their appurtenant parking space. But, you know, the association can create a framework around that installation, and I prepare a restrictive covenant for my association clients to use. But it sounds to me like you're working a lot with associations who want to install a common area station, right? Where it's the association who is doing the installation, not an individual owner.
Yeah, there are a handful of clients that are thinking it more long-term and really making the significant investment to address it for each individual unit owner. But for mostly budgetary purposes and to kind of crawl before running, most clients are trying it in some type of more common area to try it because, you know, it is costly. This is a costly investment, particularly with the electrical upgrades and the electrical work that needs to be done. You can't just, you know, take the charger and plug it into, you know, a regular outlet. So, you know, there's a lot of due diligence that goes into this. You know, we've had to bring in some cases, FP&L. We have to bring in electrical engineers. We got to do some analysis of existing electrical infrastructure and where are these spots going to go? Because ideally, you want the chargers as close to the meter room or the electrical room as possible to minimize cost. So there's a lot of due diligence and legwork that goes in. And again, very similar to an elevator modernization or elevator maintenance. Unfortunately, it's all unique. There is no simple answer. You know, every time you've got to go to the property and you've got to do a site survey and really understand from the client what their objectives are. But again, no doubt it's becoming more and more common of a thing. And we're just trying to get people as quick as possible up to speed while we're getting educated on it because, you know, technology is moving fast.
Listen, our legislature supports this because they passed a bill basically saying associations, you cannot prohibit this. They want to encourage people to start using, you know, electric vehicles. But you mentioned technology. How do you prevent today's technology from being obsolete in a few years? You mentioned Europe just a few minutes ago in the technology with elevators. I read that they have in some spots the actual parking space that you drive into is charging the vehicle. So how do you prevent today's technology that they're installing from being absolutely obsolete in a few short years?
So that's one of the reasons we took the approach of coming in more as an owner's rep than an installer ourselves, because, you know, we don't want to get stuck having equipment and being the company that owned a bunch of VHSs as CDs came to market, right? And we talk about Amazon, and yes, you know, you can go YouTube and you can see how Amazon today has warehouses full of robots and the robotic machines self-charge themselves. You know, I've had some healthy debates with some individuals that driverless vehicles is the future. So when is the future? When is that? We don't know. That could be 30 years from now. That could be 25 years from now. I love my parents. My parents still have never used an ATM.
I don't think mine have either. So
yeah, so there's always going to be some demographic that's not going to be adopting some of this stuff or will adopt it at a much slower pace. But what we've done and what I firmly believe in, it's all about the customer. We've really done our due diligence. We're working with one particular car manufacturing charging company now where using the experience from before and from all the years, we basically structured agreements that basically protect the association. So when a charging station is installed, between the maintenance and or if software or modifications evolve and there needs to be an upgrade, it's all included in the maintenance agreement. Mm-hmm. Because again, especially associations, which are non-for-profit buildings, you know, they can't afford, you know, this nickel and dime concept. Right. So that's the approach that we're working with so far. And so far, it's getting a lot of traction and clients are really intrigued by it. So that's the path we're going. And we believe firmly that that's the right long-term solution for the client.
Well, that does make sense. You were in the management industry. You were a regional president at the Continental Group, which is the predecessor to First Service Property Management. And you and I have been talking throughout this episode about, you know, associations hiring companies to handle their elevators. And now we're talking about electric vehicle charging stations. What did your experience in the management industry teach you about how volunteer boards and managers evaluate their choice of vendors? By the way, I have very definite ideas on this because I think my experience tells me that they evaluate vendors on price. They overly rely on how much is it going to cost. But I want to hear your experience.
You're kind of spot on, right? You know, often in the review process that they, you know, go from to that last page and what's the price? And that's a very dangerous situation sometimes, right? Penny wise, pound foolish. But, you know, I think just backing up, I think big picture, you know, the associations need unbiased advice, especially when it comes to specialized technology type things. It's unfair. I think it's unrealistic to expect, you know, residents to expect the property manager all of a sudden to be a subject matter expert and or a board of directors to be experts in all facets. So, you know, they really need to count on these subject matter experts who are truly customer centric, who are really thinking long-term for their client, you know, who are really focused equally, not just what's best for their client, but for the reputation of not just the consultants, but the contractors. You know, I've worked very hard over the last 20 plus years, focusing on my reputation, my long-term reputation, both in the community and the industry. And, you know, unfortunately, I've seen over the years, especially when there's new products or new concepts, you know, there's a handful of new companies that will enter, you know, the South Florida market, you know, with a lot of marketing dollars to spend that will often get traction with new clients until attorneys get involved. And hopefully attorneys are involved before to look at the contracts and make sure there's non-performance provisions, which unfortunately sometimes there's not. And that's why we talked about what we talked about earlier. We just, like you, want to see people avoid the mistakes that have happened in the past. Doesn't matter the industry, but so between the overpricing or not delivering on service of goods, we just want to help make sure that clients are going to truly unbiased, subject matter, transparent experts in an industry to guide them for the right long-term solutions. If the association, as like we said earlier, goes to the last page and only cares about the price, even if that's the short-term solution, you know, that's ultimately the buyer's decision. But, you know, we're going to try to guide them with what the right long-term solution. But that's the methodology that, you know, I've really focused on in my career and we think is important, especially with some of this very costly technological stuff.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to that, Todd, is give yourselves time. So if you're doing anything in a rush or a panic because you've waited to the last minute, your choices are going to be limited and you're probably not going to make as good a choice as if you'd let, you know, allowed yourself some months for lead time to, as you said, really search out those subject matter experts, really do your due diligence, figure out what you want in terms of the technology, in terms of the particular vendors that are available to you. Just give yourself time. I just want to end with one question. As you know, a very close source has told me that you are an excellent tennis player and that you represented the U.S. in Israel's Maccabiah Games. I got to ask, what was that like?
It was beyond amazing. You know, I come from a family of tennis players. My father's 81 years old. He played collegiate tennis at the University of Miami. My brother played at the University of Delaware. So, you know, it was a beyond amazing experience for my father, my brother, and I, each to proudly represent the United States in this summer's games. You know, it's basically the Jewish Olympics. Most people don't know. I didn't know until we qualified and competed that it's the third largest international sporting event in the world.
Wow. How many countries participated?
I want to say 85.
And you represent, and your dad represented the U.S. too at this?
My dad not only represented, but he proudly, and if anyone sees him walking around Miami with his bronze medal, he will let you wear it and take a picture with it.
That is fantastic. Congrats, Mr. Schwartz. That's fantastic.
Yeah. He definitely is super stoked about that. And to answer specifically your question, you know, the most amazing part was, you know, there was an opening ceremony. There was 20,000 cheering fans, including President Joe Biden. And so to walk on the stage, through the tunnel, on the stage with my dad and my brother in front of everybody, including my wife and my children and children's boyfriends, it was a lifetime experience that hopefully we will get to do again in another 4 years.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, again, thank you so much, Todd, for joining us today. You've really, really imparted a lot of knowledge about elevators.
My pleasure.
And electric vehicle charging stations.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us today. Don't forget to follow and rate us on your favorite podcast platform or visit taketotheboard.com for more ways to connect.